Imagine a hospital where the heart and lung surgeons refuse to collaborate because their billing software is fundamentally incompatible, which is exactly how modern society operates. This source material explores how specialized institutions fragment our crisis response, proposing a new civilizational healing grammar supported by AI to reconnect them. So let's dive straight into the feedback.
The conceptual architecture of the healing grammar is immensely robust, yet its practical application remains overly abstracted from the realities of entrenched political power and institutional friction.
Yeah, I mean, we are looking at a massive gap here between a beautiful theory and a very, very messy reality.
Definitely.
Early on, the text outlines what it calls functional differentiation, which, you know, for anyone casually following along, that's essentially the idea that our society has broken itself into highly specialized domains like law, medicine, economics.
Right, and each domain speaks its own language and optimizes for its own specific goals.
Which creates massive blind spots where they overlap, right?
Yeah, and the author diagnoses this perfectly. I mean, they propose boundary institutions to bridge these silos, which is a fantastic concept.
Totally.
The weakness, though, is the assumption that these isolated domains will willingly participate in this so-called reflexive integration. It completely breezes past the fierce, well-funded resistance from vested interests.
They just kind of ignore the reality of it.
Exactly. Because these domains actively benefit from staying isolated. The author calls this organized irresponsibility. But then they treat the solution, the bounded healing episode in section 10.1, as a purely theoretical exercise.
Right. You just can't philosophize away a multinational conglomerate's profit margin.
No, you really can't. Let's pull on that hospital analogy I mentioned at the top. So we have brilliant specialists for the heart and the lungs, but nobody is treating the whole patient.
Yeah, nobody is looking at the big picture.
Right, so the theoretical grammar says, let's create a boundary institution so the heart and lung departments can communicate. But isn't the author underestimating the financial incentives keeping those departments separate?
Oh, absolutely. Like, if the lung department gets paid per procedure, regardless of the patient's overall survival rate, asking them to coordinate with the heart department literally threatens their revenue model.
Right.
Why would the hospital administration agree to this if it costs them money and, you know, slows down their operations?
Well, that is the exact friction the text is missing. The literal cost of communication, both in capital and in operational speed, is what those vested interests will weaponize to fight this integration.
So how do they fix that?
The suggestion here is to ground the theoretical framework early on, by anchoring the text to a high-stakes, real-world case study. You need a bounded healing episode that you can use as a recurring narrative device from chapter one all the way to the end.
Okay, so we need to see them drive this beautiful theoretical engine through the mud, essentially. What kind of case study are we talking about here?
It needs to be big, and it needs to be messy. Think of like a multinational fossil fuel transition or a massive historical water contamination crisis in a major city.
So introduce it right up front.
Exactly. If you introduce a detailed scenario, like a city's water supply being poisoned by industrial runoff, right in the introduction, you immediately ground the stakes.
Oh, I see how that works. Because then when you get to the abstract charts later in the text, you actually have characters and stakes to plug into them.
Yes, precisely. Take Table 2, which outlines these cross-domain blind spots. Instead of just listing economics and ecology as abstract concepts, explicitly map the chosen water crisis onto the table.
Okay, so show the reader exactly how the chemical plant's economic demand for quarterly profit clashed with the ecological need for clean groundwater.
Yeah, and show how the legal domain was weaponized to protect the plant, while the public health domain was left footing the bill for the sick citizens. Make the reader really feel the friction of those overlapping blind spots.
That makes a lot of sense. The material makes a strong case for integrating these systems by highlighting concepts like responsibility and resource compacts.
But again, to make that concrete, the author needs to detail what it actually looks like to force that chemical plant to adhere to these compacts despite their massive lobbying efforts.
Right. Like, how do you compel a system optimized for quarterly returns to suddenly answer to long-term ecological metrics?
Well, by illustrating that maintaining silos isn't just a failure of imagination, it is a highly profitable architecture for those who can externalize their harms.
So going back to the hospital analogy.
Yeah. If a failure in the lung department financially impacted the whole institution, they would suddenly care very much about the heart. The material could dramatically improve by demonstrating how a bounded healing episode forces a reallocation of those underlying incentives.
Ah, so in our water crisis example, what if the boundary institution had the legal authority to map liability across the domains?
Exactly, because suddenly the chemical plant can't externalize the healthcare costs of the poisoned citizens.
You hit them where the optimization happens. Which brings up a really interesting point. We just spent all this time talking about the financial incentives that keep these silos separated.
Right.
But there is an engine out there actively making those silos taller, thicker, and, well, more profitable every single day. And that brings us to the core technological issue in this text.
The introduction of artificial intelligence as a historical hinge arrives too late in the manuscript, causing the narrative to feel like two distinct papers stitched together.
Yeah, I mean, the first half of the material provides a sweeping, masterful sociological diagnosis of civilizational history.
It really does.
However, artificial intelligence, which the author rightly identifies as the critical catalyst that will either amplify our destruction or enable civilizational intelligence, doesn't appear until Section 8.
Which is way too late.
Right. Why is it sequestered so late in the text? It just feels like a separate add-on.
It is a massive structural weakness. By waiting until page 20 to introduce AI, the narrative fails to explain why this civilizational grammar must be adopted right now.
It just loses that sense of urgency.
Exactly. So the suggestion is to foreshadow AI's dual nature as both the ultimate optimizer of fragmented silos and the potential infrastructure for integration right in the introduction and weave its presence consistently through the early historical and sociological genealogy.
But, you know, doesn't the author need to establish the sociological foundation first? If I'm reading this, I might think they needed to build the philosophical house before showing how AI sets it on fire.
I mean, you can absolutely build the house, but you can't let your target audience leave before the fire starts.
That's a great point.
If the author is trying to reach the technologists, policymakers, and engineers building these systems, and those people stop reading at page 10 because they think this is purely a history of sociology, well, the manuscript fails in its primary goal.
They just tune out completely.
Yeah, the author needs to show technologists that functional differentiation isn't just an abstract theory. It is the exact blueprints of the machine learning models they are training today.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, AI isn't a new phenomenon disconnected from the past. It is the ultimate realization of this selective rationality.
Right.
Let's look at section 3.2. So the author discusses the interface problem and how digital systems perfectly optimize only what can be measured. They need to explicitly flag this as the precursor to modern AI systems.
Yes, and they really need to do it aggressively. In section 3.4, when discussing Beck's concept of organized irresponsibility, the author must mention how AI scales this exact phenomenon exponentially.
Okay, yeah.
The material discusses how algorithmic proxies replace human purposes, so bring in an AI-specific example right there.
Like talk about how a healthcare algorithm might be trained to predict healthcare costs rather than actual health needs, just because costs are easier to measure.
Exactly. Bringing that technological reality into the sociological critique immediately raises the stakes.
Because AI is currently optimizing our silos at light speed.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about social media algorithms prioritizing user engagement over public health or political stability. The machine is doing its job perfectly, but the patient, society, is getting sicker. It's the ultimate blind spot.
The author creates this brilliant dichotomy between system intelligence and civilizational intelligence.
Right, system intelligence being the ability to optimize a specific silo, like an algorithm maximizing clicks, and civilizational intelligence being the wisdom to govern how all those systems interact.
Exactly. That distinction is the beating heart of the manuscript's urgency. The author should really move a condensed version of Table 6 into the introductory chapters.
As a framing device?
Yes. It serves as a framing device for the entire critique of modernity, establishing immediately that we are building massive system intelligence without the civilizational intelligence required to survive it.
So by pulling AI into the introduction, you validate the technologist's worldview immediately.
Yep.
And then you use the sociological history to show them the blind spots in their own code.
That is exactly the move.
But, you know, if we are pulling AI into the first chapter to capture the attention of the people building these systems, we have to recognize a fundamental friction here.
Oh, definitely.
Technologists and software engineers do not speak the language of academic sociology. Handing them this manuscript as it currently stands feels like handing a brilliant, high-level architectural blueprint to a team of bricklayers, but the blueprint is written in a language they just can't read.
While the semantic architecture successfully avoids totalizing, the highly academic terminology obscures the actionable nature of the proposed framework for non-sociological readers.
Yeah, the text relies heavily on dense, highly specialized vernacular. Terms like post-totalizing civilizational normativity, polycentric ecology of boundary institutions, and recursive consequence review, they are incredibly precise.
Extremely precise.
I understand why they are used, but they risk completely alienating the policymakers and interdisciplinary practitioners the paper actively aims to equip. The vocabulary creates an ironic interface problem of its own, trapping these brilliant solutions inside the silo of academia.
It is the ultimate irony of the piece. The suggestion here is vital for the text's survival outside of a university library. Pair the dense theoretical definitions with immediate, plain language translations, analogies, or practical equivalents that a policymaker or technologist can readily implement.
Let's actually workshop that a bit. So in section 10, the text defines reflexive integration.
Right.
What if we compare it immediately to an interdisciplinary translation engine or an API for public policy?
Oh, an API is a great comparison.
Right. Using the concept of an API, an application programming interface, helps a software engineer grasp the concept instantly. An API is just a structured way for two completely different pieces of software to talk to each other without having to rewrite their core code.
Yeah.
That is exactly what a boundary institution is trying to do for these sociological domains.
That is a phenomenal translation. You keep the academic rigor, but you hand the reader a tool they recognize immediately.
Exactly.
Look at Table 8, which outlines boundary institutions for reflexive integration. The author should add a plain language column illustrating what this actually looks like in practice.
Okay, like what?
For instance, take a phrase like recursive consequence review. To a city council member, that means absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all.
But if you translate it into an actionable example, like a city council is legally bound to reverse an algorithmic zoning law if public health metrics drop after 2 years, suddenly the theory becomes a tangible, deployable policy mechanism.
Wow, yeah, I love that. But I do have to push back here because I know why the author chose these specific words, and it wasn't just to sound smart.
Sure.
How do we ensure that simplifying these terms doesn't strip away the essential guardrails the author put in place?
That's a very valid concern.
For example, the text is extremely careful to avoid words like cure or normalization when talking about society. And it uses phrases like post-totalizing civilizational normativity. That is a mouthful, but it's there to prevent this framework from being used for social engineering or worse, eugenics.
You are hitting on a crucial tension here. We absolutely do not want to dilute the rigorous protections the author has built. The historical danger of words like healing or curing is that they have been used by dictators to justify horrific practices.
Right. You know, treating vulnerable populations as diseases to be eradicated for the sake of the social body.
Right. If you tell a system to cure society, the system might decide that eliminating a certain demographic is just the most efficient optimization. Precisely. The author uses a term like post-totalizing civilizational normativity to prevent anyone from claiming they have the one absolute blueprint for a perfect society.
So it means we are setting norms, but we aren't enforcing a totalitarian vision.
Exactly. But translation doesn't have to mean dilution. You can maintain the guardrails by using functional analogies rather than academic jargon.
So how do you translate post-totalizing civilizational normativity for a policymaker without losing that safety net?
Instead of just summarizing it as flexible boundary setting, you explain the mechanism. You describe it as setting the foundational rules of the game so that no single player, no single domain, can rewrite the rules to dominate the others.
Oh, I see.
You keep the academic term as the precise legal and philosophical anchor in the text, but immediately after you provide the operational definition for the person actually building the system.
Right.
You say, in practice, this means designing an AI governance model that structurally cannot prioritize economic output over human rights. You bridge the gap between the philosophy and the code.
It's about giving them the why in academic terms, but the how in their own language.
Exactly.
Let's recap the three actionable suggestions we've uncovered in this critique to help the author bridge these gaps. First, ground the theoretical grammar by integrating a concrete, high-stakes case study of a bounded healing episode, like a massive water contamination crisis.
Right.
Will hinge throughout the earlier sections. Don't wait until section 8. Frame AI as the ultimate optimizer of our current silos to drive the urgency of the manuscript and hook the technologists right from the start. And third, break out of the academic silo. Pair the brilliant but dense sociological terminology with plain language analogies and API metaphors. Ensure that the practitioners, engineers, and policymakers who actually have to deploy this framework can understand the architectural blueprint.
Yes, we want to genuinely thank the listener for submitting this deeply fascinating and vital piece of work. The depth of thoughts, the rigorous guardrails, and the sheer scale of the vision here are truly remarkable.
They really are.
We invite you to implement these structural and stylistic adjustments and submit your revised material back to the critique for further exploration.
Because at the end of the day, we can have the most brilliant specialists in the world working in the heart and lung departments, but if we don't build a language and a system that forces them to step out of their silos, look at the whole patient, and override the billing software, the hospital fails. Thank you for joining us.